Good morning. My name is Lori, and I'm an alcoholic. When I was invited to speak on this topic, I immediately thought this could not be more perfect, because I came here thinking that spirituality was a term used by people who had indulged in too many outside issues. I was a spiritual blank. I was raised on a farm in a alcoholic family. My dad was an alcoholic, although we didn't know it at the time. He was scarier sober than he was drunk, truly. And my mom was defenseless and helpless. He wasn't physically violent, but we all tiptoed a lot. One of his favorite lines was that he had had religion shoved down his throat. He wasn't having his kids anywhere near it. And it seems that I learned some lessons that my parents taught me. Most of them were not the right lessons. One of them was that I developed a very deep belief that any kind of God was a crutch, was a weakness, was a bad thing. I learned that I never could do enough or be enough. I could not do it right, and there was not really much point in trying. However, I also grew to be an overachiever and a perfectionist. And so I don't remember the first time I got drunk. But I would be 13 or 14 at probably a country ball game, after the ball game, I would say. And as I say, I don't remember when it was, but I am almost certain that from that point on, I never refused a drink on the grounds that I didn't want it or that I had had too much. It's really lucky that I grew up on a farm. I think my parents might have had a little more difficulty with me if I had grown up in town. As it was the 50s and 60s, and my mom didn't drive. We didn't have access to being in town a whole lot until I became a teenager and my friends started getting driver's licenses. So I drank warm beer. And it took me a lot of years. I practiced at that for about 5 or 6 years because I didn't get legal until I was almost 20, at which point I became a barfly. I loved the bars. I loved the pool. I loved the atmosphere. I loved the smoke. I loved the whole dang thing. And that went on. I was having fun. As far as I knew, I was having fun. But in retrospect, I would not wish my teenagerhood on anybody. I would not go back to that for any money whatsoever. In my next life, I'm not doing it that way. So once I hit my 20s, the topic being living by spiritual principles, at the age of 19, I had a pretty good handle on how I felt about things, why I reacted the way I did, who I was. But then I got legal. And I don't remember ever consciously drinking at anything. But I also, over the years, stopped writing in my journal. I stopped knowing why I did things. I just drank. And I always did. From the moment I became legal, when I wasn't working, every day I went to the bar. Luckily for me, in British Columbia, we didn't have Sunday bar openings. And I blame Expo 86 for the fact that I became a 7-day drinker because the bars opened then. So in my 30s, I started trying to stop drinking. I thought it would be nice to not wake up every day with a hangover. And I managed a few times. I made the mistake, for all the difference it made, it wouldn't have made any difference, but I always quit drinking with someone. And that doesn't seem to work because sooner or later one of you decides to have a beer and the other is off to the races with you. I should say that through this time, I fell into a really wonderful job in the newspaper and eventually left there for the local print shop. I also lucked into a very stable, if drunken, marriage. We met in a cabaret. We stayed drunk together happily for about 25 years until drinking stopped being fun for me. I didn't stop drinking at 25 years. It just stopped being fun. So for several years, starting, I think, you know, I used to play darts, and I loved it because you had an excuse for being drunk at 10 o'clock in the morning at dart tournaments. That stopped being fun because I had reached a point where if it was 10 o'clock in the morning, I was well drunk on any day. And darts stopped being fun. I couldn't look forward anymore to weekends and long weekends. I would just go, God, I don't even want it to be Friday, because I knew if I wasn't working, I had to drink from the minute I got up. I convinced myself I didn't like coffee, but the truth is it interfered with the beer in the morning. If I didn't like coffee, I could have a beer instead, right? My parents used to occasionally come over to visit on Saturdays, and I dreaded that because I would be drunk when they came. And there's no way to hide that. When you drink beer, you smell like beer, right? I always liked it when my older brother came to visit on Saturday mornings, because then he would be having a beer too, and then it wouldn't be so bad, right? If I went to the store, if I took my pets to the vet first thing in the morning, I will have had a beer. And how I didn't know that beer really, really reeks is a mystery to me. I still had a job. I still had a good job by the time I stopped drinking. I don't know how much longer it would have lasted. And after I quit drinking, my boss told me that in the morning I didn't smell very nice. And I can't imagine. I was the main customer person. There I am, reeking of beer, shaking like, I can't believe my boss let me carry on. Like, even if he had just got a new front office person or something, because I really was good at my job. So about 95, the beer kicked in too hard. I couldn't dance anymore because my feet got too heavy before the dancing started. Nobody was asking me to help with anything anymore. I was still reading, but I was rereading a lot. And I knew that there were no good drunks left. I knew from the first beer, I think I would maybe feel a little lift. But by the end of the first beer, I could feel myself going down. But I didn't have a choice as far as I could tell. I still had to get totally drunk after work every day and carry on the weekends that way. I went to the liquor store once and got my weekend supply. It must have been a new cashier, I guess, because she said, big party this weekend? I said, no. Oh, dear. So at the, in early November of 1999, I went to the doctor, and I can't remember why. I assume it had something to do with alcohol, although I probably didn't say that. And it was a new doctor who hadn't seen me before. So she said, we're going to do a proper physical. And she said that the palms of my hands showed that I was developing a bit of liver trouble. And so she did proper tests and stuff. And I did. But the thing about it was, what it felt like to me was that she had given me permission to stop drinking. It just felt as if I had just been waiting for somebody to say, it's okay, you can stop. Because I'm a creature of habit, and I, quite a lot, I do what is expected of me. And everyone, including me, expected me to be drunk. And so I didn't see how I was going to stop doing that. There were a few old men around Smithers who used to be really bad drunks in the bars. And I would see them here and there around town, sober and happy, and people liked them. And so on, and that's not that people didn't like me. I was always surprised that people still treated me with respect and still liked me. That just blew my mind all the time. But these, I couldn't figure out what they had done, and I was hoping that maybe there comes an age when you've had enough, or maybe there comes a point where you've had your quota. But I just couldn't see it. I really thought nothing could stop me. But the doctor gave me permission. So it was November, early November, and I said, can I wait until after the Christmas holidays to stop drinking? Because it's important in your large family to be the only blotto person on Christmas. And anyway, she said, well, yeah, you're not dying tomorrow. So I set my sobriety date for the first working day after the Christmas holidays, which was January 3rd, 2000, and that is my sobriety date. I went with my friend after work to the Legion, which is where I hung out, as usual, and the bartender didn't offer me a beer. I don't know if I would have taken it had he offered it. I have to tell you, though, that through the Christmas holidays, through November and December, I have sisters who don't live in my town, and I'd be emailing them saying, why can't it be January 3rd? Why can't this just stop? But I could not stop. I don't think I could have stopped on January 2nd if you had threatened my life. But January 3rd was the day. I had never wavered, and I went to the bar. I did not have a beer, and there has been since then, there comes a time when I've had my quota, apparently. There was one day at a dart tournament, the first dart tournament I played after I got sober. Because my darts have no idea how to fly sober. It was bad. My darts went into the floor, 3 feet in front of me for a long time. So I was in this dart tournament, and at one point I thought, if I just had a few beer, my dart would work. And then I thought about tomorrow, and I thought, I just am not going to do that. And that's the closest I have come to a craving since I stopped drinking, and I'm very, very grateful for that. Because I have never done anything in my life on willpower, and I had nothing except for the fact that I didn't have the craving anymore. I had nothing to keep me sober. I did not know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything. I knew AA existed. I knew that they met across the alley from my house because I went to a meeting there once, and it was either about 6 months or 18 months before I stopped drinking it. But they wanted me to wait my turn to talk. I was really drunk at the time. I can't remember if they said keep coming back. They did give me a big book, which I didn't read at the time because it was pretty clear that AA wasn't for me. So when I quit drinking, I didn't know, as I said, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know that life wouldn't get better. Life did get better because I wasn't drinking. There was that. And for a few months, it seemed that life was actually going to be pretty nice. And then I started going down. And depression set in. Right around the time I quit drinking, two things happened. The technological computer graphics hit my job. I'm a typesetter, a snip and paste artist. My job didn't exist anymore, really, although I still had a job, but I didn't have the will to make the transition. That hit me really hard. I thought I had a job I loved till I was ready to retire. And my job stopped existing. Also, a person came into my department. I had been a one-person department for 10 years, and I don't share space well. And we had a little bit of a personality conflict on top of that, so everything kind of hit. I had a nervous breakdown. I quit my job, not completely, because my boss and I like each other, so I would fill in what I could when I could. And so I just went down and down for the next almost 4 years. I reached a point where I would get to an intersection and have no idea what I was doing next, where I was going. I couldn't make a decision. I knew that if a decision had to be made, if anything had to be accomplished, it had to be done before noon, because I didn't have a brain afterward. I was so lonely, so lost. I didn't know anybody like me. I didn't have anyone to talk to. So in the fall of 2003, in November of 2003, I finally broke and realized that I could not help myself, and thank God for that. So at that point, things started happening. I got some medicine, which got me up where I could hear and see a little bit. I remembered who I was. I talked to a friend accidentally who said that he had joined AA a couple of months before, and they know two things. They know about anxiety and depression when you stop drinking, and he told me that it's not a God program. And I needed to know that. I don't think I could have stayed in AA if I had come when I stopped drinking, because the God thing would have been too big. I needed to be as broken as I was. It took those 4 years to get me where I was teachable. And when I reached AA, it was okay with me if they said the serenity prayer. And they said, you know, God was still pretty hard for me. But almost immediately, I started seeking. And as soon as I started seeking, it felt right. It felt like this was what I had been waiting for. A couple of revelations that came, that I was given very early was, you can change, and it's okay to change. I didn't know that. You can accept things as they are. I didn't know that. It's okay to fold paper so that the corners don't match perfectly. It's okay. Tradition 3 taught me that if you come to AA, you have a right to be in this room. That extends to the world. The traditions have given me principles that expand into my whole world. The principles of AA, of acceptance, tolerance, patience, I did not like people when I came here. Now I see them, and it takes me a while not to like them. They have to prove that I shouldn't, instead of the other way around. I am so grateful for this program. I am so grateful for being as broken as I was. Thank you so much for being here.
The second speaker is Donnell M. from Ireland.
Good morning. My name's Donald. I'm an alcoholic. And I drank enough hard liquor to qualify for a chair in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I got here, my life was full of misery and depression. And unless I could experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks that I've seen other people take with impunity, I couldn't cope with life. But today I have that sense of ease and comfort. It comes by taking a few simple suggestions. 12 simple steps that have rocketed me into a fourth dimension of living. You know, those first couple of drinks worked at once. That was fast. But to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of living, that's pretty quick too. So, in December 1972, my world came to an end because booze had me beat, and I knew that I'd have to stop drinking because everything that was of any value to me in my life, I was losing it, and losing it fast. So I knew I had to stop drinking, and I knew from here on in, without booze, Life was going to be a life of doom and gloom and boredom. Every bone in my body knew that. Yeah. But I also knew that that was the way it was going to have to be, because I played the game my way, my rules, and I lost. So I stopped. And for 5 or 6 weeks, I shook and shook and shook, until eventually I could maybe start to eat a little and get my head, you know, a little bit together. And I decided, well, I had all this free. I was a daily drinker. I drank all day, every day. You know, that was what it was. I was a pub drinker. So I, you know, had all this free time now. What was I going to do, you know, with all this free time? And I decided, you know, I'd have to do something to fill on all this time. So I thought I'd do a bit of gardening. Gardening sounded good. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do a bit of gardening, you know, I need to get a greenhouse set up, because my part of the world, we get a lot of rain and stuff. So I was going to start at the top anyway. So I rang an old school friend of mine who was in the construction business, and he might have a few connections, and because he lived in the town where I wanted to buy this greenhouse. So I rang Sean up, and I hadn't spoken to him for 6 years. We went to school together. He lived about 70 miles away, and I rang Sean, and it had a great conversation on the phone. And as I say, I hadn't been talking for years, and he was telling me what he'd been doing and what happened to him, and he'd been in England, and he'd been in a very good job in the construction business, and he was over a lot of men, and you know, but drink caught up with him, he said. You know, and he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for, he had 11 months sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous when he spoke to me. And I was interested. You know, I was interested in the story. So I invited him down to my home for the weekend, and we sat in the front room of my house on a Saturday night for about 7 hours talking about this thing. Well, Sean done most of the talking. But just for the AA record, Sean celebrated his 43rd birthday last February. And he's one of the most active people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. He carries this message. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made my first discovery, and that was that I was an alcoholic. And I had no problem with that. You know, you people told me to keep coming back, and that's what I did. I kept coming back. And at the end of 6 months, I made my second discovery. And that was that that insidious insanity that precedes the first drink was no longer with me. It was gone. Totally gone. Lifted out of me. And I began to realize that I had done nothing to achieve that. All I'd done was kept coming to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I realized, you know, this was happening to me through the grace of God. You know, because I did nothing to achieve this. You know, all I'd done was kept coming back. And then you people explained to me what that word grace meant. You said it was a free gift. You know, that you couldn't earn merit and be worthy of the grace of God. It was a free gift. And it's a gift that I cherish today, and I've been cherishing it for 42 odd years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I often say the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous had a great year. You know, it was just get out of jail free card, wasn't it? And, good things happened in that first year. You know, that bit of a business that my father had given me, I almost lost it. It wasn't much of a business, but it was all I had. So I held on to that, and I owed the bank a lot of money. And I didn't know how I was going to get out of that. But I kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that first year, as I say, was good. Second year was pretty good, too. That old business sort of got a lift up, you know, things started to improve. And year three was great, too, because, you know, the business was going well, things were going well, AA was going well, I was doing service, and I was happy. And year four was pretty good too. By year four, the bank owed me more money than ever I owed them. But somewhere around the end of year four, there was a few dark clouds arrived over the horizon. That lady I was married to, well, let's just say she wasn't as gracious as I thought she should be. Especially when she was taking a little liquor. So things got pretty rough then too, it was difficult days, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kept coming back because I had to live close to you people. And it was around that time that I took this step three that we talk about. Up until that time, but by this time, all my resources, and I had a lot of resources by that time, but those resources marshaled by the will were insufficient. They failed utterly. I was beat. Here I was with this problem, this lady I was married to. My sobriety, I felt, was being threatened and so forth. And very quickly, it's amazing how things happen fast in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a good job because most of us start, late in life. But she crossed the corridor from the Al-Anon room to the AA room. And things looked up from there on in. But that just wasn't quite right, Things got even more stressful and more difficult. And I seemed to be in the wrong side of every argument in our household. And at the end of maybe the fifth year or so, maybe sixth year, I can't remember, things got so bad that, to make a long story short, I knew her doctor and I went to see him. It turned out that her doctor had diagnosed her as having a deficiency in Valium. So we got her into rehab, and she's got 37 years in this program today. She told me we're married now 49 years. I have a wife, a life beyond my wildest dreams. My old sponsor said to me, he says, this thing has to come first in your life. And has to remain first. Has to come before your family. Has to come before your business. Has to come before your church. Your causes, if you have any. And he was right, because all these things have become first class in my life. I have a first class family today. I have 5 sons. I have a Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and a Paul. Not bad for a failed Christian. I was 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ran into trouble. Big trouble. In God's economy, nothing is wasted. Because that forced me to have a look at really what this program was about. And step 11 became very important to me in my life. And today, step 11 is the most important part of my day. I have 20 minutes in the morning in meditation, and another 20 minutes reading my inspirational books. Those are my prayer books. And it's the best part of my day, and it's the most profitable part of my day. I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous today say, well, I really don't know how to meditate, I don't understand it. Well, let me tell you, there's no wrong way to meditate. You know, there is a few helpful ideas, okay, you know. But these last three steps in the program are the steps that I try to live by. Practice these principles. There was a famous flautist. I think he was an Irish man. And he's been interviewed in television, and the interviewer asked him, he says, now that you've reached the pinnacle of your career, you've played at all the great venues in the world, the Carnegie Hall, New York, Sydney Opera House, Berlin Conservatory, Oma Arts Center. He says, do you have to practice on the flute these days? And a great man says, well, he says, if I didn't practice for a week, he says, I would know it. And if I didn't practice for a month, my audience would know it. So I practice these principles in all my affairs. On awakening, I ask God to help me with my day. You know, we all know the promises in step 9. But if we have a look in page 84 and 85 of our book, we'll see another 12 promises. You know, step 10 says we continue to take this personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admit it. We vigorously commence this way of living, it says. Watch out for resentment, fear, you know. Fox says the two keys to hell are condemnation and resentment. Resentment, we say, is the number one offender. Destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It blocks us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. I believe in the great law of life, what you sow, you reap. And this is a law that fools a lot of people. And sometimes it fools me too. I think I get away with things. Little judging you and little condemnation and resentment. But the law always pays me back. But it fools me because it doesn't always pay me back in the same coinage. Sometimes it's a different currency that he pays me back in. But it's a great law because it works both ways. When I do the right thing, good things happen in my life. The fruits of the Spirit are happy, joyous, and free. That was the promise that you people made to me when I got here. You would have a life beyond your wildest dreams. You know, I thank God for the people around me today and where I've come from. And my own home family, my both parents, and I often think of my parents now, particularly my father. You know, I'm reminded of what Winston Churchill said one time. He says, when I was 17, he says, the stupidest man he knew was his father. But when he was 25, he was amazed how much his father had learned in 7 years. How are we doing? You know, this has been a life really beyond my wildest dreams. You know, so many good things have happened to me. I keep getting amazed by the way things turn out, you know. You know, that lady I'm married to, you know, she's with me this weekend, and she's not in the room today. She decided she wanted to go down to that shopping mall and spent my kids' inheritance. I have 5 sons, as I was saying. 2 of them are in this room today. Paul, who lives up in Newport, Rhode Island, he's got 5 years in the program. And Matthew has got 6 years in the program. And he lives up in Connecticut. And I can tell you, those 5 kids of mine haven't given me half the trouble that I gave my parents. That's a fact. I can say that without the the fear of successful contradiction. Great family. Great guys, you know. And they have produced some very, very interesting grandchildren. And they're a joy to behold in my life, you know. They have taught me what unconditional love is. Beautiful, you know. I do a lot of gardening now. It took me 15 years before I got that greenhouse, by the way. My house is on an acre of ground, and I have landscaped it. And I do a lot of gardening, and it's a great passion of mine. And those grandchildren, there's, you know, seven of them live within a stone's throw where I live. So I'm very fortunate. And they come around and visit a couple of times a week, and they have great fun playing around this garden, because there's all sorts of things in it, all sorts of gazebos and towers with spiral staircases and streams and bridges and all this type of, you know what we're like. And if anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. Our book tells us that God has a purpose for each one of us. You know, as a Jesuit priest said that we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. And our book tells us that God has a purpose for each one of us. We're in this world to play the role that He assigns us. To the extent that we do, that He would have us, do we match calamity with serenity. God bless you and thank you.
And our third speaker is Stacy W. from Mississippi.
Good morning. My name is Stacy, and I am an alcoholic. And here comes the tears. So, as I told my friends, I cry, and so that's going to just happen. And I'm used to it now. My sobriety date is May 10th, 1998. And thank you. It was Mother's Day. And I do have a son. I'll get to that story in just a moment. And my home group is the Courage to Change group. We're a literature study on Wednesday nights in Vidalia, Louisiana. So if you ever get lost in Louisiana, you'll find yourself in Vidalia. We're in the middle of nowhere. But please stop by. So when I first heard about this topic, living spiritual principles, I got on the internet and I thought, God help me because I don't know what to talk about. And I have a sponsee that I call Google her name, and I thought of her, so I Googled it, and I was like, tell me a principle I got to talk about here. And then, as Donald, as he said, that meditation in the morning is so important. And yesterday, in meditation, it came to me that this whole life we live today, the steps, the traditions, the concepts, are the principles. And thank God for meditation, because y'all would hear a totally different story this morning. So when I first got sober, it was Mother's Day, as I said, and I was in jail. And I always thought, what's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? And let me tell you, those women are rough. And I was very scared, almost as scared as I am right now. And And this was the second time, and it was a DWI, so I didn't spend time, you know, in prison. I just was in jail for overnight stays. And I had a spiritual experience. I was brought up an atheist, and I don't know if I was. I just prayed in case, because I heard in school that there was a God, and I went to Catholic school, and, you know, I didn't want to get to heaven and not be let in if there was one. And so I just sort of prayed what they told me I needed to pray. Not that I followed any of those values or principles, but just in case. So that day, I was sitting there, and like I said, I was very scared, and I had this complete moment of peace. I had a complete moment of surrender, and it's very hard to describe, as most of you will, or if you've had one, know. And I knew at that moment that everything that was happening in my life at that time was my fault, and that I was the only one. I couldn't have said at that time with a higher power, but now I can, that was going to be able to change what was going on in my life. My son didn't know where I was. I started out, if you're from Louisiana, we have crawfish boils. We have any excuse to drink. I started out at a crawfish boil at 9 o'clock that morning drinking, you know, ended up in jail at that night, not knowing where my son was. Luckily, I had good friends that took care of him. And so when I got out, I was very willing to live a life of misery. AA was suggested to me about a year and a half before, and I just quit talking about my drinking. And I was in therapy, and I just didn't talk to her about that anymore, because I couldn't imagine. I was 30 years old. My family lives till they're 100. How do you go 70 years without a drink? You know? My great-grandma was 98. My, you know, great-grandfather was 92. My aunt was 102. So 70 years was a long time to think about not having a drink. And so we just quit talking about that, and I just kept drinking. But when I had this experience, I like what it says in the Appendix 2 about the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. One of the things I never wanted to be in life was a goody two-shoes. And that was one of the things that I always was, actually. And so to me, that meant that I had to be this goody two-shoes. I wasn't going to be the life of the party. I wasn't going to be the cool chick. I wasn't going to be all these things. And at that moment, I couldn't care less. I wanted it to stop. And so I decided that they had a meeting down the street from my house, and I decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had a few other things to do first, so I didn't actually make it till the next week. I actually didn't realize they had a meeting every night. I just thought that it was on Thursday. That's when I made it. So I wrote down some notes. I can't even read them because I was nervous writing them down to keep myself on track. And one of the things that I realized that when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, my personality had changed, and I did whatever you had told me to do, whatever you told me to do. I still had my old ideas. I still had all myself, you know, coming into this program. So when I first went to the meetings, there were young men, and I was very excited. Like I said, I was only 30, and they were sober, and I was going to be sober, and we were just going to be happy. It was just going to be great, you know? And I got sober in New Orleans, so I'm not from Vidalia, but I got sober in New Orleans. And, so when I walked into my first meeting, all the men gave me their number. I gave them mine. I was excited. This was going to be great. And I got a sponsor, and well, what happened was I asked this woman, and her she was going out of town, so she gave me 5 phone numbers, and one of them was a man. So I called him. Why call the women? Y'all were my competition. And so he was an older man, and so I thought there wasn't going to be any problems with that. Of course, I'm an alcoholic, and I can make it work. So there was problems, but he taught me a lot, though. He taught me a lot about being on time, responsibility. And today I consider spirituality action, and those things brought me closer to God. Being on time meant losing my selfishness and that it was all about me, and being responsible, not going out and smoking a cigarette in the middle of the meeting. I can sit there for 1 hour getting my coffee before and not getting up in the middle. Things like that. They were very simple things, but they made a huge impact in my life. And so working these steps began to make even more of an impact in my life. I remember working the step, 5th step, with a man. Not a good idea. First of all, I wasn't honest. So for me, it wasn't a good idea. And I didn't want him to know all of the things that I had done while I was drunk. You know, it was very embarrassing, especially talking to him that, you know, I might have been somewhat of a slut. And I didn't mean to be. It just happened, you know. And so... So I didn't say those things, you know, and I had problems with my family and my, you know, this is other issues, but growing up I had problems with dads, so I didn't talk about that to him. And so the next meeting I went to, I remember this very clearly. So the next meeting I went to, they said that once you do step 5, you can't ever do it again. And I know today that's not true, but what I heard was, oh my God, I still have all these secrets. And what am I going to do now? And so I got real scared. But of course I didn't talk to anybody about it. I just got scared. And and so I lived with that for a couple years. And this woman came into town, and, you know, we tried to hide this relationship. It's just like hiding your drinking, right? You try to hide that you're in a relationship with your sponsor. And I thought nobody knew it, and everybody knew it. And when she came into town and wanted to ask, and she asked me about what was going on. You know, she was very direct, and I didn't like that. I was like, whoa, lady. She just wants to find out the scoop. And anyway, she became my sponsor, and I did another 5th step. And the point that I'm getting to is that I remember when I started writing that 4th step, everything was coming out. I was crying. I was all night long. You know, because I didn't write it till the night before we were meeting. And all night long I was crying, and I was upset, and, you know, just all these emotions. And I knew that I couldn't keep those secrets anymore, that I wouldn't stay sober if I did. And I remember calling her, and she was married, and I said, I don't want to see your husband. I don't want to see anybody. I barely wanted to see her. And I felt so ashamed. And what I remember is after we had that, I could walk out her front door. I could look you in the eye. I could talk to her husband, and I was somebody again. Another spiritual experience for me. These things are so hard to describe at a microphone, right? But if you're a recovering member of this program, then you know what I'm talking about. So, I go to a literature study. I've been in a literature study now for almost 14 or 15 years. And you always find new stuff in the book. They always throw stuff in there. I had about 5 years of sobriety, and we were doing the eighth and ninth step, and I was sitting there, you know, with my ego thinking I had it made. I've got 5 years. I know this stuff, blah, blah, blah. My life is great. And I was meeting a new man, and he was in AA. And actually, he's my husband today. He said I needed to mention him, and he's here. And he actually has a birthday, AA birthday, tomorrow. I have more time than he does. But we didn't start dating when he first came in. So anyway, I was sitting in this meeting, and this guy was sharing a story about his, how he had stolen some stuff from his stepdad and how he needed to make amends and stuff like that. And as I mentioned earlier, I didn't have the best childhood, and resentments were the number one offender, and I still had a huge resentment and a deserving one, I thought, against my stepdad. And I could justify it to you, and you would agree before we left today. But maybe. Anyway, and God he works so wonderfully, right? Pain is this touchstone of all spiritual growth. So, I'm sitting there going, I don't need to learn anything else in this program. I've got it. 5 years, you know. And boom, I remember when I was 16, how I had set up my family to get robbed and have all his stuff stolen. And even though I don't regret the past, I do wish that I could get something back that I had stolen for him, because it was very important to him. And anyway, I remember talking to my sponsor, and she was like, you're going to have to make amends. I said, hell no. I am not admitting this. I am not telling anybody this but you, and that is it. And I don't have to tell anybody this. Blah, 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 blah. So for 6 months, I lived in turmoil and fear and pain and anger because this kid came in and brought this up and all of this. And one day, I was driving home from work, and I had just had enough. I had enough. And so I decided to call him. And she said I had to do it face-to-face. And anyway, I called him. And we don't have a great relationship, and we never have, and we're okay today. We have the best one we can, but he was like, we don't need to meet face to face. We can do this on the phone. Now, not to tell his story, but he is an alcoholic. He had gone to treatment. In fact, my husband was in treatment when he was in treatment. This was in the 80s, so before I, we had to go to families, and he was there, and I didn't know him at the time. Anyway, it's a small world. So anyway, I called him, and he said that he wasn't going to meet face-to-face, and he knew what I was doing. He knew I was in AA, and he knew I was doing the ninth step. And so I told him what I had done, and I told him that I would do anything. And at that time, I was willing... Well, I looked it up to see if I would be put in jail, you know, like the statute of limitations and all that stuff. So of course I was willing at that time to suffer whatever it was, because I wasn't going to jail. But you know, the most wonderful thing happened, and he said, you know, one of the things that I felt through your whole life is that that pain that you had growing up as a little girl. And, you know, he went into how much he saw of the pain that I had gone through with other things. And totally not what I expected that was going to happen. He said, I'm not going to tell your mom. And I said, you can do whatever you want. You know, and that was one of my greatest fears, is that my grandfather would find out, because he was my higher power. And And at that time, I really was willing to let that go and for him to find out who I was and what I was. And he hasn't to this day that I know of, although my family keeps really good secrets, so you never know if they know or not. But it changed me in my personality again, another experience for me, in that I was able to step out into the sunlight of the Spirit and be free. That promise is my favorite one. You will know a new freedom and a new happiness. And from that moment on, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness because I didn't live, I have fears, don't get me wrong, but I didn't live in fear of people finding out something. And so, if you haven't done 8 and 9, do it. So, I better look at my notes here. 2 minutes? Oh, wow. Okay. So real quick, you know, I always ask God to let me know what I need to say, and he does. And part of this I had no plans on saying, and part of it I did. So it hopefully one person in the room heard something. I practice step 11 to the best of my ability on a daily basis. I practice these traditions. These traditions I really wanted to talk about a little bit, and I only have 2 minutes. But the first one, unity, I had to practice in my life because we had this dog who was a menace to the neighborhood. He was very mean, the sweetest thing to us, but he was so protective of us. And he would chase old ladies around the trees, and he would try to bark at men and women that passed by, kids. He was just terrible. And I mean, the people in our neighborhood were scared to go out their door because Scooby-Doo might be out. And I mean, Scooby-Doo, how cute is that? So we tried training him. We tried everything. And then my sponsor quoted the first tradition to me. You know, personal recovery depends on AA unity. And I know that they're not in recovery, my neighbors, but they were afraid to go out their door because of me and because of my dog. And so I had to take care of that. And I mean, we were getting stories from everyone around about how you might lose your house and just random stuff people were saying. And, one of the decisions that we had to make was one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make, in my life. And that was to put this beautiful dog down. And because I was very afraid of other, where I live, there's a lot of dogs on chains, and I did not want that for my dog. And so we did. And I haven't second-guessed it. I have felt bad. I felt like we could have done something different, but it just didn't happen. And I know that people breathed a sigh of relief that Scooby was not in the neighborhood anymore. And so these traditions work. They make you make hard choices, but we are better for them. We grow from them. And I'm so grateful for that. We have a hard choice we're making now, and it doesn't stop. And I'm so grateful for that because I still have so much to learn. And today, I don't think, like I did at 5 years, that I know it all. I absolutely know nothing. And I'm grateful for that because it lets me off the hook. Thank you very much for listening.
All right, I'd like to thank my speakers, Lori, Donnell, and Stacy.